Words on Water.
Welcome to the Clean Water Act Regulatory Issues in a Pandemic. The Water Environment Federation thanks you for your time in participating in this webinar. My name is Claudio Trinin. I'm Senior Director of Government Affairs here at the Water Environment Federation. Our moderator today will be Susan Sullivan. Susan is Executive Director of NUIPIC. NUIPIC is a regional commission that helps the states of the Northeast preserve and advance water quality. Their mission is to advance water, clean water in the Northeast through collaboration with and service to our members and states, to their members and states. Susan is also Vice Chair of the WEF Government Affairs Committee, and we welcome her to moderate this webinar. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you, Claudio. Welcome, everyone. We appreciate you joining us today. For clarity, today actually is March 20th, and as Claudio mentioned, we are talking about the Clean Water Act regulatory issues during a pandemic. I have with me some colleagues and friends that I'm excited to introduce and have speak to you about this issue. We're going to go in the order that it showed on the slides here. So Melanie Davenport, then Shelley Chard, then Fred Andes. To introduce our speakers, Melanie is the director of the Water Planning Division at the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality. Her responsibilities include both permitting and compliance programs for Virginia's PDS program. She also does stormwater, erosion, and sediment control, wetlands and streams. She deals with CAPOs, biosolids, nutrient trading. Some of her relevant past positions include Director of Enforcement at DEQ, and she's been working or has worked for 10 years in environment as an environmental attorney in private practice. Melanie is actually currently the president of the Association of Clean Water Administrators, or AQUA, a role she took over last summer. Shelley Chard is the director of the Water Quality Division for the Oklahoma Department of Environmental Quality. She's held that position since January 1st of 2010, and she has over 27 years of experience in the drinking water and wastewater profession. Today, Shelley oversees drinking water, wastewater, stormwater, and water reuse and operator certification. In addition to her activities at DEQ, she holds leadership positions in the Association of Clean Water Administrators, the Oklahoma Water Environment Association, the Groundwater Protection Council, the Association of State Drinking Water Administrators, and the Water Environment Federation, where she currently serves as chair of WEF's Government Affairs Committee Regulatory Subcommittee. Our friend Fred Andes is a partner in the Chicago and Washington, D.C. offices of Bonds and Thornburg and the leader of the firm's water team. He is involved in counseling and litigation on issues arising under various federal and state environmental laws with a special emphasis on Clean Water Act matters. We've asked these three speakers to join us today to speak during the COVID-19 pandemic on water and wastewater, as our water and wastewater utilities are currently triggering their response plan for continuity of operations. As you can imagine, they're all wrestling with meeting pollution and reporting requirements, as well as dealing with workplace safety issues. The events that are happening now trigger regulatory issues under the Clean Water Act as our utilities work to maintain compliance during this pandemic. Utilities need to be able to consider their special conditions in their consent decrees and or their permits. They need to look towards their regulatory obligations, and they need to maintain close contact with their regulators, all while making sure that they are keeping their staff safe and healthy. At this time, what I would like to do is turn over to Melanie so that she can begin her remarks. Thank you for joining us today.
Susan, thank you so much for the introduction, and thank you for participating with us on this webinar. I have a few general comments and perhaps disclaimers up front. And the first thing I want to say is that you guys, as operators of wastewater and water treatment facilities, are critical in protecting human health. We know that even in the absence of a pandemic. So we do consider you our partners as we work through the issues that we are all facing. Another thing I want to say is that I'm speaking as the president of AQUA, but these are kind of unusual times. And normally, before giving comments like this, I would have really been able to reach out to a number of my colleagues in other states. So to the extent that we've all been busy with a lot of things, I really did not have that opportunity. So my comments are partly Virginia's perspective on this, but I also think that the basic principles will probably be utilized by your state. I just don't have the certainty that I usually have when I prepare remarks for a presentation like this. Another thing I want to say is that conditions are changing rapidly, and what we talk about today will certainly have application going forward, but we really obviously can't predict what might happen 2 weeks from now or a month from now. So just want to make sure that, and I know that you guys are also facing that challenge. And the other thing I wanted to say is we haven't had a lot of contact with EPA. So I've been able to talk to my folks in our regional office, but we really, they're dealing with a whole number of issues just like we are. So again, this is the state's perspective. And then finally, Virginia, I know that there's a sense of frustration that you might not be able to get the answers that you wish you had to move forward. We have been inwardly focused in Virginia for the last week or so to the extent that we are trying to figure out how to protect our workforce and how to protect the communities that we work with outside of the agency. And I have been kind of the thorn in our leadership team side by saying, look, we have to figure out a communication to our permittees and the outside world. We've got to start looking to the outside because we know questions are going to come up. So I don't have even a detailed response from Virginia's point of view. I do know, you know, that some of the things that I'm going to talk about today, we have discussed at a fairly high level. But there's a lot of details that I am not able to provide at this time. So let me start with what we're doing in Virginia. We actually had a kickoff last Friday where we directed our staff to, we strongly encouraged voluntary teleworking. We happen to be very fortunate at DEQ because the vast majority of our workforce has been set up with laptops. So it's pretty easy for folks to go home and do their work. So to that extent, we are not anticipating interruptions in services, particularly if you've got permit reissuances or things like that. We also are available. Your permit writers should be available for conversations because we've told everybody, forward your work phones to where you are and business as usual. Then on Tuesday, we decided that we were going to take a two-week stop on field activities, both monitoring activities and inspections. It corresponds to some of the advice in terms of isolating and this two-week period that folks that the professionals seem to think might be associated with the virus. But more importantly, what we're doing is regrouping on our end and trying to articulate protocols that will protect our staff and the general public and recognize the request of social distancing. So we are not in the field. That started on Tuesday, March 17th. It's going to go for 2 weeks. And we're looking at things like, for example, our stream gauging network. Guys in that program can't go out individually. So are we going to suggest they take two vehicles so you don't have two people in a car or truck at the same time? They're also a program where they traditionally go on the road for 4 or 5 days at a time. We're going to prioritize stations that can be reached in a single workday, because we don't think it's a good idea to ask our staff to be spending nights in hotels and eating all their meals in restaurants. So we're trying to adjust. We have heard, that some of our permittees have restricted access to their facilities, and we will certainly respect that. But we're just trying to figure out, you know, how do you keep this government service going in a time like this. The other thing we have talked about internally, and again, haven't spoken to EPA, but we have all kinds of grant commitments and obligations to perform inspections and do this and the other thing. We're expecting that if conditions continue as they are, or perhaps even worsen, that we'll have to have those conversations later on with EPA. But again, we haven't had them. So that's kind of where Virginia is in terms of how we have altered our operations. As Susan mentioned, I've actually spent most of my career in enforcement. I've been the water permitting director since 2011. So I have that experience of compliance and dealing with noncompliance and moving things to enforcement. So the principles that I talked to the DEQ leadership team yesterday, again, you guys are our partners and you play a role in human health protection. So our starting point is that we expect compliance with permit limits. That's the critically important thing as we move forward. If violations are discovered because of all of these things swirling around, whether it is a lack of administrative staff, whether it is a breakdown in laboratory capacity, whether it is simply a matter of there is, you're not meeting your staffing requirements because a certain number of your folks are ill, we can and will use reasonable enforcement discretion. But right now, we need to focus on compliance and safe and environmentally protective operation of your facilities. And the priority needs to be on monitoring and testing and documenting that you are in compliance with permit limits, because as we all know, those are designed to protect human health and the environment. What we can't do is to predetermine enforcement discretion decisions. And that is not to scare anybody or to be a deterrent to doing the best that you can. What I can tell you from Virginia's point of view, and I have heard this from a couple other states, that we will certainly, we certainly recognize the challenges in complying with permits, and that we will exercise reasonable discretion when things are said and done. But the most critical thing is that we need information and documentation that permit limits are being complied with. If you find that you have activities that you just can't do because you have prioritized operating your facilities to protect human health, we need you, or we suggest that you document the justification of pandemic related disruptions. So you have that in your file when we come back and talk about this later on. The other thing is, it is really, really, really important for you guys to communicate with your states. For example, in Virginia, our Emergency Operations Center is asking us for information about interruptions of treatment of domestic sewage. We don't want you to be worried about non-compliance at this point in time. If there are things going on at your facilities that we need to know about, we need really, really close communication from you guys, because you are our partners in protecting human health in this part of where we find ourselves. So with that, I am going to turn over the conversation back to Susan, and she can introduce our next speaker.
Thank you very much, Melanie. What we thought we might do is leave most of the questions that the panelists have for each other and till the end, and I'm going to turn it over to Shelley Chard, Director of Water Quality at Oklahoma DEQ. Thank you, Shelley.
All right. Thank you all very much for joining us today. Thanks to Susan, Melanie, and Fred. I know we're going to have an opportunity for some dialogue at the end and some questions at that point. So what I would like to do is I'm going to go through a series of slides. Mostly you can just kind of read those. I'm going to talk about what some of those mean. And then at the end, I've got, you know, some more targeted remarks that I want to make. So wanted to start with just some early actions that we have taken for our state agency. We have activated our emergency response team and our emergency operational protocols. This was done a couple of weeks ago. We are engaging daily with our Office of Emergency Management that has statewide responsibilities. For water and wastewater, we have what we call a strategic alliance, and that includes our Office of Secretary of Energy and Environment, and then all of the water agencies, includes our state financial assistance program. It includes our water quantity agency, water rights permitting, all of those sorts of functions, and then the water and wastewater activities here at DEQ. We also, that group includes some of our technical assistance providers, the Oklahoma Rural Water Association. We work very closely with them. And we started kind of working to see what emergency response might look like for them in assisting us and our small systems. We also have a system which most states have something like this. They have named them different ways, but it's basically, for us, it's Sooner Warn. It is basically a dedicated website that where small systems can go in, make requests for whatever they might need. Typically, we use this, for us, it's tornadoes, ice storms, power outages, flooding, those kinds of activities. But we did modify Sooner Warn so that there can be a request for an operator or operator assistance. That we think is going to be critical as we start seeing some illness in our operational staff. So those were kind of those first immediate reaction things we've got to take care of. So then over the last week, we have moved more into our intermediate actions. These are some things, you know, that we're kind of really amping up. Our internal protocols are set up. We have about 650 people that work in our building, which includes the State Environmental Lab. We're down to about 25 to 30 people that are in the building on any given day, and most of those are laboratory related. Our senior management is meeting daily by conference call, just going through any late-breaking news, any activities we need to address. Then the directors are engaging in daily calls with our management team. We're engaged in daily, sometimes twice daily calls with Rural Water Association and others. And probably the biggest and most helpful thing we've been able to do, we have a dedicated page on our website, and we have posted letters to our systems. We've posted operational changes, kind of how we're handling operator certification, how we're handling permitting and compliance requirements, and I'll talk about those here in just a second. So if we can move on to talk about permitting. With what Melanie said, just to comment on that, we are officially, all permit conditions remain in effect and all deadlines in our orders remain in effect. However, enforcement discretion is how our system is set up to handle variations and emergency situations. Right now, our instructions are maintain compliance. We have hotlines set up that are our normal process that our systems are accustomed to using. If there is a emergency situation, either illness of staff who cannot totally operate the plant, if it is a matter of lack of laboratory capacity, we have a system in place where they can send an email or make a phone call. All of that gets logged. It becomes part of their record. And then we ask that the systems keep track of that information as well. And then that's what we will use to justify any actions taken or not taken. We are working with our bigger systems to help provide assistance to smaller systems. We are working with our district engineers so that they are essentially fully functional while we are outside the building, while we are not open to the public. We are not doing routine inspections right now. Interestingly enough, we have a couple of cases that have some national significance and some federal law enforcement interest. And so we're having to handle those a little bit differently. But again, all of that is being done in a way to protect our employees and to protect the employees of these water and wastewater systems. As we start working through all of this, we know there's one key single most important function that the agency has in response to our regulated community. If we can advance the slide, please. So that is, we want to communicate. Without communication, this whole process just falls apart. It's hard enough under normal operating conditions. But when we're in this time of every day is a new day, communication is most important. And I think you'll find most of the states are approaching things in a similar manner. It's not exactly the same. But this is the most important issue. I can't say it enough times. In working with our technical assistance providers, working with our communities, our industries, and our staff, we have to stay connected, we have to communicate, and we're kind of in uncharted territory, so we know that communication is going to be so important as we move forward. Reach out to your state. I will echo something Melanie said. We haven't heard much from EPA. I know they're dealing with their own set of issues, both internally with the states and the regulated community. But definitely, if in doubt, reach out to your state through whatever mechanism they have set up. For Oklahomans, we have our telephones are all being answered. You should see no interruption of phone and email availability of the DEQ staff. Like I said, the actual in-person field inspection side of things, that's going to be something that will be evolving over time, and we're going to have to figure out what that's going to look like. Before I wrap things up, I would say, you know, make sure to check your state's website, see what they have posted. They should have additional instructions. If they have a what we call .gov delivery system where we can send things out, it's a mass mailing. Anybody who signs up gets that communication. That's a great tool. And to close, I would just say thank you to all, not only for spending some of your time with us today, also to say thank you as public health and environment protectors. We're all in this together. And for those of you that are operators of systems, you don't get enough credit or enough recognition. We talk about all of the first responders and healthcare professionals. I think you guys need a shout out, not as first responders, but continuous responders, continuous operators, because without you, we could not protect public health and the environment the way that we do. So with that, I'll turn things back over to Susan.
Thank you very much, Shelley. I appreciate your comments. Coming from the Northeast, I think that one of the messages that I could share is our states are in similar circumstances as Virginia and Oklahoma. I don't think you're going to see much differentiation between the state responses at this current time. For the most part, I think all of us are worried about making sure that mission critical functions of protecting public health from the threats are happening and that the staff are able to be safe and still be able to maintain safe plant operations. Shelley's point about recognizing how hard all of the folks in the municipalities are working, I think, is important. We all recognize that that is a critical element of their day-to-day work, and we're looking forward to helping them however we possibly can. At this time, I want to turn the conversation over to Fred Andes. As I mentioned before, he's a partner at Bonds in Thornburg. And Fred, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you, Susan. So we work with a lot of water and wastewater agencies. And I would say that in the discussions we're having with our municipal clients, the message is very consistent with what we're hearing from Melanie and Shelley here. First, two things that are very critical are documentation, and second is communication. And in terms of communication, what we are urging every one of our agencies to do is to make sure first that you know how your state agency is functioning right now. Are the offices open? Are people available on their regular phone numbers? Are there other changes in, you know, if you have a problem, you need to know who you're going to talk with in advance and if there have been any changes in how you communicate with them. For example, we are having questions we've raised to agencies, to states, where we have certain reports that are normally hand-delivered or FedEx to them. If their offices are closed, how do they want that done? And they are then getting back to us and saying, well, send us this part, you know, send it in the mail, but this part we want emailed. So it's important to have that communication process open, which we are having with states and with EPA regions, so you know what you're going to need to do and how it changes from how you ordinarily do it. Also, documentation is critical because, you know, I'm hearing from some people, I'm sure everything will be okay because the agencies won't enforce things against us when we're going through this emergency. And one of the things we've tried to stress is when things get normal and everybody comes back and looks at your documents, at your records, they need to be able to see what happened due to the emergency. They're not, the state agency, and I think you're hearing this, is not just going to say, oh, okay, everything you did during those months is fine. Rather, they're going to want to see, all right, did you have some problems that were happening before coronavirus that continued? Or were you having some issues that just happened once the emergency occurred? You need to be able to show them the records that certain things only happened because of coronavirus and how you address them. So then they can use that enforcement discretion and decide not to penalize you for those issues. It's not going to be a get out of jail free card. you're going to need to have that documentation. And that documentation extends to a lot of different issues, whether that's testing, whether that's reporting, and the possibility that you may be late in filing some reports. There may be staffing requirements. There may be construction projects that you need to delay because of coronavirus. All of those things are potentially subject to penalties for not complying with requirements, and you want to make sure to have clear documentation of why you're not able to do those things on time. Now, one of the questions that has come up in all of this has been, people will say, well, I've heard about force majeure, and do I need to exercise my force majeure rights? Force majeure is basically an act of God defense, which is in most federal consent decrees and some state decrees and orders as well, not generally in permits. So what force majeure is if you have an act of God, you have something beyond your control, you can provide notice and say, look, I couldn't do X because of a factor beyond my control, act of God, something else that I didn't do, and therefore be excused from being late in compliance. Most federal consent decrees that communities have do have a force majeure provision. And if you have a consent decree or an order that has a force majeure provision, you need to review it very carefully, because they are very specific in saying, and they're all written differently. Some say within 72 hours after you know about a possible delay in compliance, you need to notify the agencies orally or by telephone. There are a number of ways that are usually specified in the decree. And then you need to follow up with written notice. And if you don't do that, you won't qualify for the defense. So if you have a decree or an order that has a force majeure provision, and you should be reviewing your decrees and orders to see if they do, you need to consider when to exercise that right. I know some communities that are saying, well, we're going to provide a general notice now that coronavirus may delay compliance with some requirements, and then follow up later on specific things. Some people are waiting until the specific things occur and then provide notice. Everyone needs to assess those issues on their own specific basis, including what language is in your documents. So that's something to think about in terms of making sure that you file the necessary notifications and reports so you can use that force majeure defense if it applies to you. Bear in mind also that as a municipal agency, you may have contractors working for you, and they may provide you with a force majeure notice because they may say, hey, look, we were going to start this construction project for you, but we can't get enough staff, or our staff can't all work together because they'd be in close quarters, and we're going to need to delay that construction project. So you may be hearing from them that they're going to need to delay a project for you, and then you need to think about whether you need to provide notice to the regulatory agency, to the state agency, that in fact your compliance will be delayed. So that can get sort of complicated. The other factor in there to think about is insurance. Your contractors may have insurance for potential damages that may apply to you. So again, that's an issue to think about. If you have contractors who are delaying performance and you may have a claim against them, they may have insurance to cover it. So that's something to consider. Going back to permits, and we've been talking with US EPA a bit, and I understand they are discussing issues like providing some guidance on when and how people should make force majeure claims. But at the same time, my discussions with US EPA indicate they understand that in some ways, if you have a decree, it's easier to assess this issue because you actually have a force majeure defense in your decree. Permits don't generally have a force majeure defense in them. Again, you got to look at your own permit, but the standard federal boilerplate language does not have a force majeure defense. So you can't just say, well, it was beyond my control, I'm excused from penalties for compliance, you need to work with your state. And you've heard from two states here about enforcement discretion. And if you have a permit compliance issue, not a decree, but a permit compliance issue, whether that's reporting, testing, staffing, anything else, you have to work with your state and understand their policy in terms of, okay, if we have an issue related to coronavirus, how do you want that reported to you? What documentation are you going to need so you can be prepared in advance to provide that? Another issue is state inspections. And you've heard from state agencies about just now about their policies on inspections, where they may be not conducting routine inspections. But I've heard at the same time from agencies, look, they still expect you to comply. They still have authority to conduct inspections, and they may do so. And we have seen memos coming out from state agencies saying, hey, guys, we still have authority to inspect. We may conduct an inspection. There may be restrictions on not doing unannounced inspections. But again, you need to understand what your agency's policy is, what your state agency's policy is. But you should assume that at any point, you may have a state agency coming to inspect and wanting to assess compliance at your plant just like they would ordinarily. You can't assume that that's not going to happen, which is another reason why you need to have your documentation ready, particularly if you're low on staff or you have restrictions on how your staff can operate. Having the documents already and available so you don't have to have staff involved as much in going to the files and finding everything, but it's all right there and available, will be very important. One other aspect that I'll mention is that for many municipal agencies, of course, your wastewater agency, you have indirect dischargers, and you're going to be dealing with them as the regulatory body. They may be telling you they can't comply for a variety of reasons with requirements. Obviously, as Noni said, compliance with pretreatment standards and local limits is going to be critical, and you're going to want to be enforcing those and making sure that your indirect dischargers understand who they can reach at your operations. They may be providing information to you indicating that they can't comply or they'll be late in complying with various requirements. Just like we've said here, you're going to want them to document that, just like you're going to be documenting it to the state. So, you know, this is all obviously made more difficult by the fact that some people are working remotely. One of the things I've pointed out to people I know who don't work in the wastewater industry is that many of your employees cannot work remotely because they have to be on site. They have to be managing the operations. They have to be conducting the operations. They have to be, you know, doing things directly at the treatment units. And so the communication process for you in terms of possibly having some people working remotely and some people on site, I know is difficult, important to think through how that's going to work and to make sure your regulatory agencies understand that because of these issues, there may be some delays in reporting issues to them. But again, the advanced communication on all of those issues will be very important. So again, we see this as, you know, as lawyers, we're used to anticipating bad things that can happen and trying to figure out how to help either prevent them or to address them once they've occurred. We're working through these issues with each community, thinking through, all right, what's in your permits? What's in your decrees or orders? Who are your state agency contacts? Are they available? Making sure that while things may be okay for now in terms of your operations, you may end up with stresses. You may end up with sick employees. How do you deal with that? And how do you document that and communicate that to the state agencies? I know that the
WEF webcast yesterday, which will be recorded, addressed a lot of those continuity of operations issues. I would just say, bear in mind that, of course, continuity of operations issues go into compliance with your permits, particularly if you have staffing requirements in your permits. So you need to be thinking through all these issues now, working them through with your lawyers, with your outside consultants, with your contractors, and with your indirect dischargers. So if something happens that needs to be addressed right away, that you have that capability and that you both communicate with the state agency and that they document the issues. So later, when we all come back and think through these issues together and assess compliance during the coronavirus period, that you have a clear pathway to show the agency that you were doing the right things, that you were doing everything you could to stay in compliance, and that therefore you're going to be in a much better position from an enforcement standpoint going forward. I think that covers the issues I wanted to cover. Susan, glad to be part of the Q&A session now.
Thank you very much, Fred. The key points that I've heard today are documentation and communication. I think that the message from our state colleagues and from Fred are stay on top of these two issues so that you're reaching out to people and you're communicating right. I think right now we have certain circumstances that may stay the same and may change tomorrow, but those two issues of documentation and communication are really important. Shelley, I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the small system issues. One of the issues that I've been hearing quite a bit about is we have many facilities that only have one operator, for instance. What happens if that person can't get to the facility? What happens if somehow they're sick? What are the options for the municipalities to deal with that issue?
Yes, so absolutely, that's a huge issue. Potentially, it's a big concern, something we've been working on in Oklahoma. We do have one operator on a very remote, very small system that his COVID-19 test is pending. So what we have done is we've sent out information to all of our systems. We've gone through our technical assistance providers, through the Rural Water Association, and have been reminding people that this is a great time to reach out to neighboring systems to build some relationships so that in an emergency they could rely on each other for operations. We've modified our Sooner Warn, which is our statewide emergency response request service, basically. In the past, it has had things on that list such as, I need a generator, I need some chemical, chlorine, whatever it is. We now have, I need help with operations as one of those items. And so we have, through that process, we are collecting a list of operators that are willing and able to go operate other systems. Typically, some of these are higher level license holders that have retired but are willing to stay connected with the industry and to assist. We're seeing some of our larger systems reaching out to these small systems so that they have that ability to assist them with operation either by giving instructions over the phone or actually being able to go and be there. There are also several states are starting to have some conversations about 3 weeks ago on how we could do temporary reciprocity for operators. Typically, states have application processes, demonstration of the license, paying a fee, but we're working on a different process, at least with Oklahoma and some of our surrounding states, where you would keep copies of relevant information on site, and we would deal with it all after the fact. So those are some of the operational issues that we've been trying to work through ahead of actually needing a larger group of operators operating systems that aren't really their own system. We also, on any plant updates, construction projects for several years have had, you know, requirements or trying to drive more SCADA and more computerized operations. Our large systems have that figured out. The smaller systems, that's harder. But anywhere where we do have the ability to operate remotely, Rural Water Association is working with those systems so they can assist in operation from a distance. So those are a few of the things that we're looking at and that we've been doing.
Thank you, Shelley. Melanie, would you say that's similar to where you are in Virginia?
We are definitely starting the inquiry about reciprocity. We have an operator training and assistance group here at Virginia DEQ. And I did hear a little bit of good news yesterday, which is that we seem to have more operators in Virginia than some other states do. So
you might want to share them with the rest of us.
We have been sending out the communications to our whole operator distribution list, what we've been getting from WEF. So we're trying to keep everybody in the loop, and we have yet, thankfully, to hear of any challenges. But we're looking about how we can meet those operational needs, too. I wanted to follow up, if I may, on one thing that Fred said, because we actually got a communication from one of our systems earlier this week about illness and operators and invoking force majeure. And I thought to myself, I don't think there's a force majeure clause in our VPTE's permit reg or in our permits. So I opened the reg and I read through it, searched for force majeure, and in fact did not find language. So then I thought, well, maybe I'm missing something. So I actually queried all of my permit program managers and said, do you have force majeure language in your permits? So some of those are state-only permits, are pollution abatement permits, are wetland protection permits. And everybody came back, and I actually think we were all a little surprised to say, you know, no, there isn't force majeure language in any of our permits. There is a condition, a part two condition applicable to all permits in our VPTE's reg, which comes from the federal NPDES reg, which talks about only unusual or extraordinary discharges. And it notes that unusual and extraordinary discharges include, but aren't limited to, any discharge resulting from. And the fourth one is flooding or other acts of nature. You know, this is sort of, I don't know what that means. I mean, obviously I know what flooding means. I don't know what other acts of nature are. And that was actually one of the questions that I had posed to my Region 3 contacts to see if there was any guidance from EPA, because again, that comes straight from the federal reg. And I haven't heard anything, but I have instituted that inquiry. I do think it's kind of interesting because I never really thought it through, but as Fred said, virtually every administrative order or judicial consent decree that I've ever seen in Virginia has force majeure. They may be different, there may be different language in that paragraph. It may be open to interpretation, but my conclusion is there is nothing that provides a force majeure protection in our permit. So again, I've learned something as I was digging into that issue.
Yeah, this is Fred, and that's a common situation, that the decrees do have force majeure, and people assume that there is language like that in their permits, and there's not. So because there isn't in the federal boilerplate. There are some provisions in the federal boilerplate, as states have translated it, that could be used. For example, there are upset provisions. right? And so that applies to technology-based limits, where you have an exceedance that's beyond your control. But again, you have to document that and provide notice. There are provisions on sort of planned or expected noncompliance. If you know in advance that you're going to have noncompliance, although that usually relates to some kind of change in activity, one could argue that you might have a change in activity due to coronavirus and know that it's going to put you out of compliance, and you could possibly use that provision. So what we're suggesting people do is look carefully at the permit language, and particularly the part you don't always review carefully, which is the boilerplate at the back of the permit, the general conditions, and assess which of those you might be able to use when you're having a problem due to coronavirus. But yeah, well, you know, people assume that there's some kind of force majeure defense, and if you actually look at the permits, we're not really finding that, but we are finding these other provisions that we possibly could use. And if there's not a provision that you can use to say we're exempt from liability, still that goes back to, okay, so let your state agency know of the situation. It's going to make it much more likely, and they may require some documentation. It's going to make it much more likely that even if you're not exempt from liability, that the agency confirms with you that they would not plan to assess any penalties for that situation and get that documented in writing so you have that in the files.
Thank you, Fred. Shelley, do you have any response to that as well?
Yes, thanks, Susan. I would say, you know, it goes back to the whole communicate idea. For me, I oversee both the permitting and the compliance and enforcement activities for our Clean Water Act program. So we're kind of applying some of that same, instead of calling it enforcement discretion, I will call it regulatory discretion. As long as we have a system working with us, notifying us of what's going on, they're documenting in their records what's going on, we're going to definitely enforce the law. We're definitely going to protect public health and the environment, but we're also going to be very flexible and reasonable in our approach in trying to deal with noncompliance, regardless of whether it's a permit, an order, or what it is. Our biggest concern is, you know, making sure that we are protecting against a waterborne disease outbreak, whether it comes from a drinking water scenario or recreational waters. So I know that's something that we have committed to being very flexible as long as the system is working with us. And also, we've kind of touched on it two or three times, but not in any detail. But we are anticipating the system may be operating fine and having no issues, but there's a laboratory issue because the laboratory either is inundated because other laboratories are shut down or because of illness within that laboratory. You know, laboratory work can't be done remotely. So depending on how labs are rotating staff, it may become more difficult to get certain analysis done. So we're kind of anticipating that may be where we see some significant noncompliance and kind of that failure to monitor category. But as long as systems are letting us know and documenting, as Fred has said, we're going to be very open to those discussions and why that would not result in some kind of enforcement action or a bigger action or anything. So I think laboratory may be the place we see the first real issues of noncompliance. that the plants are still operating, we're still protecting public health and environment, but we just don't have that documentation because of laboratory capacity.
I think that you're likely very correct there, Shelley. Thank you very much. Well, we're coming to the close of our time. I wanted to take a moment to thank our speakers, Melanie Davenport, Shelley Chard, and Fred Andes for joining us today. Again, it's March 20th, 2020. I figure I should mention that because today's circumstances could be very different than tomorrow's circumstances. Claudio, if I could turn it over to you, and maybe you could describe how we're going to deal with the question and answers section, I'd appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Susan, and the panel. This is tremendous information. What we intend to do is we will publish a link to this webinar, and we will include an email that you can use, the listener can use to send us questions, and we will be preparing a frequently asked questions document that will be published on the WEF website on coronavirus. And we'll also have a link to this webinar, so we'll be able to connect those two. This webinar as well is a follow-on to another webinar done yesterday on continuation of operations or continuity of operations, and they go together. So if you're listening to this one, you might want to listen to that one as well. We thank you again for participation here today. And one more time, thank you for our speakers that took the time in the middle of all this to share their knowledge and their information with you. Thank you again and have a nice day. And again, today is March 20th, 2020. Thank you so much. And thank you, Susan.
Thank you very, very much. And thank you to WEF for sponsoring this. We appreciate your taking the time and energy to pull it together for us.
Words on water. Words.